Do you want to be a more successful leader of your company or any organization? I'm Rick Williams. Welcome to the Create the Future podcast. I have guests come on my podcast to share their stories about making difficult decisions that determine the future of their company. We learn what worked, what didn't work, and we have a little fun along the way. You will be a more successful leader if you listen to and learn from these stories. So I have a great guest today, and I'm excited to get started. Zafra Lerman is a unique contributor. She is a PhD scientist. She is also the president of the Malta Conferences Foundation. Zafra brings together top scientists from across the Middle East to develop collaborations and build bridges for peace. Zafra has received many international awards for humanitarian and science diplomacy, including the Presidential Award from President Clinton. She's based in Chicago. So Zafra, welcome to the Create the Future podcast. Take a moment and introduce yourself and share a little bit of your about your story getting up to this point.
Okay, thank you very much for having me. I am a scientist. My PhD is in chemistry, and I did research. And a tough decision I had to make is when I finished my PhD at the Weizmann Institute of Science in Israel, I made the decision to come for postdoctoral fellowship to the U.S. This was a very tough decision. I was a single mom by that stage and had a son and decided to come by myself with my son to a foreign country where I did not know anybody and did not have any relatives. Mm-hmm. And this was a very, very tough decision, but the decision to made me being able to help a lot of people. Another tough decision I had to make, I chaired for 26 years the Committee on Scientific Freedom and Human Rights for the American Chemical Society. And I decided to go into the Soviet Union, what was a very tough and scary decision. And not only going into the Soviet Union, I took a crash course in Russian, and I had to always go in with a group of scientists. So during the day, we were scientists. And then at dinner, I would look at somebody that looked to me reliable, and I would say, don't ask me questions, but if I'm not here tomorrow for breakfast, just call the American Embassy. And I would go out by myself after midnight in dark alleys and would meet dissidents, and we would collect them. And by 2 o'clock in the morning, we would get to a dark attic, and I would give them a seminar, distribute scientific material, and collect CVs and resumes to bring back to work on behalf of the dissidents that were there and the dissidents that were in prison or hard labor in Siberia. Now, each of these actions was illegal in the Soviet Union. It was illegal to bring scientific material, illegal to give seminar, illegal to bring back the CVs. So it was really big decision to risk my own life for the benefit of these dissidents. Big decision that I'm working on now, and it's almost the word peace sounds today so far away with the situation we are in with the war in Iran. But after September 11, I made the decision to suggest to my Committee on Scientific Freedom and Human Rights to concentrate on the Middle East. Now, it was immediately after September 11. In the Middle East, it was the Intifada. It was the uprising of the Palestinians. Suicide bombs were blowing up in Israel, in restaurants, in on buses everywhere. People were killed on both sides. And in this situation, I suggested to the board that we will organize a conference that will bring together scientists from all the Middle East countries, Iran, Iraq, Israel, the Palestinians, Syria, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, all the countries with no exception. Till now, it's still the only platform in the world that succeeded to bring representatives from all this country together under one roof. My idea was to have a 5 days conference with several Nobel laureates and provide the participants with a forum that can see what unites them rather than what separates them. To provide them a forum to meet people and stop demonizing the unknown other, and to provide a forum where they can develop collaboration on important issues to the region and the world, like water, energy, air pollution, climate change, education, where one country alone cannot solve this problem. And in 2003, in the midst of the Intifada, we had our first conference. I selected the island of Malta for that, the Republic of Malta, because I believe that an island is safer than mainland. You cannot really drive to an island. This was one part of security. And the other thing was that by that stage, there were very few direct flights to Malta, only from London, from Rome, and from Frankfurt. So I calculated that it will not be worthwhile for a terrorist to spend a whole day to get to the island of Malta and kill a lot of Muslims and few Jews, few Israelis. So this is why Malta was selected, and this is why the name Malta Conferences founded.
Okay.
I'm going to pause you only for just 1 second, and that is that your story about being in the Soviet Union, honestly, I think is one that most people who are younger than you and I are really do not appreciate what it was like in the Soviet Union at that point. And I say this in the context, I did not go there myself, but I have a very close friend who was there several times, kind of probably in the same time period that you were there, and shared stories with me of people he got to know who are asking him to bring, things out that they were writing or wanted to preserve or save for their families that, they couldn't do themselves. And just it's a history and a culture, understanding of a culture that was a lot of people lived under that I think younger people has its own definition for you and me, have no concept of today. And I think is part of what the problem we're having with Russia today is partially the residues of all that. I know that's not what we're going to talk about today. I just want to comment on that for people who are listening who maybe don't have that history in their own minds for a second. I don't know if you want to add anything to that, but it's just something that I think is worth people like you and me at least verbalizing as recent history that it carries on to the day in many ways.
Oh, sure. It's a continuation. And as a matter of fact, in my book, and I have to mention the book now, in my book, Human Rights and Peace, A Personal Odyssey, there is a very, very big chapter on this issue of going to the Soviet Union and risking my own life. I know that the young people don't know anymore what is the name Andrei Sakharov, and therefore the Soviets send him to an isolated place in Gorky where he could not be in touch with anybody. And I was lucky enough that as he was released from Gorky, I met him. He did not speak English. To really achieve, I need to know Russian, because any translator that will be assigned to me will be a KGB agent. And you right. don't do human rights with translators. And this was the reason that I took the crash course. And there is a big chapter. There is a lot of different stories. And then I did human rights in China after Tiananmen Square, that was... I know a lot of people don't even remember what is Tiananmen Square. A lot of people were in the prison and tortured, young people, students that fought for democracy. So I worked there. But the last chapter, there was another chapter in my life where I moved from research to education, because I believed strongly that science education is a human right that belongs to all. And I developed a way to teach science through art, music, dance, drama, rap, animation, and I became famous all over the world, and I became a big leader in that. But we have to get to the Malta conferences, as you suggested. So the first one was held in 2003. And I thought that it will be only one conference, and I will prove that it's possible to bring these people together.
Let me go back to the basics of how all this started. So you are somebody who's trained as a scientist, you worked as a scientist, and now you had this inspiration that you could make a contribution by bringing scientists together to learn, get to know each other as people, and step aside from whether you're Israeli or Lebanese or Iranian or Iraqi or whatever it is, Palestinian, and just get to know each other as people and see if you can bridge across those barriers that are so important and find a way to, quote, have peace. I'm using that term generally. Why would you do a crazy thing? Why would you personally take on the risk of trying to make this happen?
I'll tell you why. Because I thought that scientists have the responsibility to do it. Because mm-hmm. science can prolong life, but science, sadly, can cut life short. Mm-hmm. Weapon of mass destruction need scientists to develop. So scientists have the responsibility to work towards peace. And science is an international subject. A scientist, a chemist, for I'm a chemist, I'll take chemistry. A chemist from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, can communicate the results in chemistry to a chemist in Bethlehem on the West Bank without needing to know each other's language, because they will understand the chemistry of each other. Science mm-hmm. doesn't see language, science doesn't see religion, science doesn't see culture, no border, no nuances, it's just science, and it's very international. And therefore, I felt that it's the responsibility of the scientists to take the torch towards peace. And this was my idea why I decided to take it on and prove that when these people that are enemies or their governments are enemies and mm-hmm. are in war for so many years with each other, a scientist, they can be under the same roof, in the same hotel, eat all the meals together, have social events together, and at the end of the conference, you don't even know who belongs to which country because it's only one group. And to see the tears and saying goodbye, it's like a family reunion just ended. And if you think about that, you have the feeling that there can be peace and that people want to live in peace, with peace in each other. Now, scientists in most of the countries, not in the U.S., but in most of the countries, have a very high status in society. They are very well respected. Therefore, they have a lot of connection, and they can influence governments to really listen to them and see what's going on. We had many times with us science ministers from these countries. We had presidents of universities, presidents of Academy of Science. All these people have influence, and they saw how working together can produce a lot of results, because the countries in the Middle East are very close to each other. You know, the astronauts don't see the lines that the British put there in the Middle East and called it border. This will be one country. This is another. The water, the aqueducts, they don't know where the water, their border. They go underground and they pass many countries. And if we want to solve the issue of water in the Middle East, what is a very big issue, countries have to work together in order to solve it. And this is what they realize.
Well, I accept, in fact, I am a huge advocate of what you're saying. What I'm trying to understand, though, is you as a person, because if I was in your shoes, I would be afraid that people would say, are you crazy? Bringing together people who fundamentally hate each other?
This is the world exactly what they said. Are you crazy? This was exactly the word I kept on getting from everybody. Are you crazy?
Right, right. So, okay, people are saying, are you crazy? And then
correct.
If people might be saying, I would like to come, but I would be in big trouble with my government, my colleagues, my friend, my family, my mom, my dad, they would all hate me if I went. I mean, I'm just thinking of all the reasons why somebody would say, yeah, I can understand it could be a good idea, but no, I'm not going to show up. I'm wondering what was it like for you? How did you get yourself to say, hey, this may not work, but I'm going to do it? I mean, where did you get the courage to do this?
The country I grew up with, the values that were instilled in me very young age. And from very young age, I knew that if you feel that you want to do something, you do it and you overcome. From a very young age, I did not accept no for an answer. So everybody said, are you crazy? You're right. This was the reaction. But the point is, and this is one obstacle for doing this conference, we are paying all the expenses for all these people. So they don't have to go not to banks and not to governments and not to their universities or anywhere to ask for money. They have a very nice invitation telling them that they are invited to a scientific conference titled Innovation, Research and Education in the Middle East. Then there is a list of the Nobel laureates that will be there. When do you have a chance 5 days to eat 3 meals a day with several Nobel laureates and go and talk to them and ask them questions about your work? Where will these people have this opportunity? So all the way around, we had few countries that said that they got encouragement from higher up to go to the conference because of the high scientific level in the conference. The conference is on a very high scientific level, but it has social events and it has tours, so nobody can go alone anywhere. Touring is together. One very important rule: no accompanying members. So nobody has anybody bugging them or wanting to do something, no company member. Everything these people do together. Another important rule in the Middle East is equality. Everybody is equal, not that this country is high here in this country. As the Palestinians said to me when they start coming, they said, it's the only conference that we don't hear, oh, we had to pay money for our poor Palestinian brothers. Here, mm-hmm. Everybody's equal. We pay for all of them. This means we have to raise the money. It's a very tough task. There is a lot of money to build weapon of mass destruction.
Okay, so I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but part of what is so intriguing about this to me is that you had to overcome this idea that people would say you're crazy doing this is exactly the same that everybody who says, I'm going to start a new company, all of their friends and colleagues are saying you're crazy. So the person who says, I've got a good job, but I have a great idea that I can start a company, they are having to find the courage in themselves to overcome what everybody around them, all their friends, are saying. Why are you giving up this job to go take a risk starting a company that might fail? Well, why would you do that? But you said, I am so convinced of the importance of what I'm doing and the potential that could come out of this, that you said, I'm going to do it anyway. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that's why correct. Your experience is so important to other people.
That's what happened. Everybody is one of the people that we put together, the first organizing company, wrote in a letter about me, said everybody threw their hands and said it's impossible, but I insisted and I said, no, there is no impossible. Impossible is only if you don't try. And I was convinced that I will be able to do it because I had been in a lot of international conferences. And when I opened my mouth with my accent, the people that live in the Middle East know immediately that I'm an Israeli, but I managed to get a lot of very, very good friends, Egyptian and Jordanian and Emiratis and from all these countries. So I knew it's possible because of my friendships with these people already. And these people helped me to put the first conference together. They were scientists. We all met in scientific conferences. Now it was supposed to be only from the Middle East, not other countries. We have two countries that are not from the Middle East. It's Morocco and Pakistan that really requested to be participants in this conference. We did not invite them, but they requested and we accepted them. The Pakistani thought that they can use the Malta model to have a conference like that between Pakistan and India. We have had South Korean that talked to us about it. They thought that it can be done between North Korea and South Korea during the war between that we don't hear much on the news, but there is a war between Russia and Ukraine that is going on, and I was approached if we will do something like that for Ukraine and Russia. So people start seeing that as the model to start bringing some peace and normalization through science. And today, when we started, the term still did not exist, but today the term science diplomacy exists. So they call it now science diplomacy. And I'm saying science diplomacy can succeed where any other kind of diplomacy failed. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you an example. When the Iraqis came the first time, they came to me with tears in their eyes, and they said, it's the first time in our life we saw an Israeli person. All our life, we learned, we studied, we were told that the Israelis are monsters, they don't even look like regular human beings. And here we find wonderful people, great scientists. Why were we lied all your life? This was, for these people in the 50s, the first time to see a live Israeli.
Okay, right. No, so what I want to draw out of you is what you did to be successful. You had to have the courage to say, I'm going to try to make this. Beyond the courage, again, I'm going back to the beginning here because that is so relevant to so many other people. Did you say, okay, I need to get a partner who's Palestinian or Egyptian or somebody like that, and then bring a little group together so that you're working together on this? I mean, how did you actually start this and build a core that you then said, okay, I'm really going to launch this? How did you do that initial step?
So let me explain to you. No, I did not want to involve them because I didn't want them to get into any trouble. So I didn't want to involve anybody from the countries on the Middle East. I involved them by talking to them personally, asking to recruit participants, to vet the participant, to find good participants, you know. But I did not want them involved in anything. So
okay, what was the core?
Nobody would get in trouble. The core was American with a few British people, because today we are a non-for-profit 501c3, but we started as a project of the American Chemical Society under my committee that was scientific freedom and human rights. So this was part of that. So we had the committee. So this committee was involved. There were a few British people on the committee that were from the... We are the American Chemical Society. They are the Royal Society of Chemistry. And we had in the committee some German from the German Chemical Society.
Okay.
So we all worked together. But there were a lot of points where people were just throwing their hands and hearing what's going on. And few people, you know, had some fear even to try to organize something like that. And in one stage, even the American Chemical Society by itself said, oh, you have to get insurance from Lloyd of England. I said, who will pay for that? It costs more than the conference, the insurance. What pay for that? I don't have money to pay for insurance for Lord of England. Yes, there was fearing different people, but the organizers were the people of the Committee of Scientific Freedom and Human Rights.
Okay.
So they were the organizer of the first conference. And when the first conference was such a big success and the participants voted that it must continue, we had in 2005 the second conference in Malta. But then Malta became part of the European Union. And then a big problem started, huge, because no country was willing to give a visa to all the countries that were supposed to participate in my conference. This one did not want Syria, and this one did not want Iraq, and all of them did not want Iran. And it became a real, real, very big problem. So the third conference was on Turkey before Erdogan was president. President Gül was then, and Turkey gave us a visa for everybody. So this is how we dealt with Turkey. The first one went to a man, Jordan, but by that stage, His Royal Highness, Prince Hassan bin Talal, King Hussein's brother, was involved with the Malta Coalition. He started being involved. So he opened the conference, he gave the first lecture, and he was very helpful in everything. Then came the fifth conference that happened to be in 2011. Oh, no, this one in the book, there is a lot of story. 10 years after September 11, and all the American installation had high alert, and UNESCO and the UN declared 2011 as the International Year of Chemistry. And UNESCO wanted the Malta Conference as a finale in December 2011, when the Year of Chemistry ends.
Wow.
And I said, visa? They will get visa for everybody. Huh? But to get to UNESCO, you need a French visa. And the French did not feel exactly like UNESCO. And here started the problems that could not be overcome, because UNESCO promised that there will not be any problem, and there were problems. Then we had a Nobel laureate from Taiwan, and Taiwan, you know, was kicked out of the UN, and so of UNESCO too, so there were problems there. And this is where the visa became the biggest problem. And since then, the fundraising is a very big problem, but the visa became a much bigger problem to get. Just to summarize, at the end, everybody came, but it took, I have a chapter in my book that I titled From Mission Impossible to Mission Possible. I'll give you an example, and I'm talking before the war, in 2023, October
7, 2023,
before.
All right. Now, wait a second. I got to tell you, you are telling the story of, even though you said there was a problem, and then there was a problem with this, and then visas this, and visa that, you're telling the story of success after success after success. If I was talking to a typical entrepreneur who had been successful, I can tell you that what they would be talking about is money. Where did they get the money? How did they get? And you don't talk about money at all. And I'm just going to go back here, because I want people to come away with lessons learned about what a unique, remarkable person you are, how you made all of this actually happen. So the first thing is courage to say, I'm going to do this in spite of everybody telling me that I'm crazy. The second thing was, you partnered with established institutions like the Chemical Society to say, okay, we're going to have them as partners, or maybe even through their structure. And then the third element of this is money, because that, if you talk to entrepreneurs, leaders of young companies, they're saying, I spent all my time trying to find money, either my first customer or my equity partner or my banker or who the heck it is. Where did the money, how did you finance all of this? And I don't mean in great detail, but did it come through corporate sponsors or the chemical societies or individuals?
Yes.
And you didn't even think this is important, but I got to tell you.
No.
Anybody who's an entrepreneur says, my gosh, this is the most damn important thing there is. So how did you make that happen?
No, the most important is to get the visa for the people to come. If you don't have a visa, they cannot come even if you have money. Then comes the money. You have to raise the money. And this is a pain in the neck. You are right. Writing proposals to different places. So like few of our places don't exist this year, and we have a conference. The National Science Foundation supported us, but they are cut drastically. They don't have money. USAID supported us, but they don't exist anymore this year. So all these changes caused us tremendous problem. So you write proposals to places that you can see that can fund. This is what you do. You ask the chemical societies to support. The American Chemical Society supports every conference. The other societies in the beginning supported the European, but they stopped supporting. They said they don't have money. They are in much tougher situation, but the American Chemical Society support. There are foundations like the Bader Foundation that the chemist started. They support individuals. You write letters. You use your charm and everything you can in order to raise the money. But you must raise the money in order to have the conference and pay for everybody. You don't have any other possibility. So yes, it's a big problem to raise the money. And I wrote the book, all the proceeds of the book go towards the Malta conferences. So every one of your audience that will go on Amazon and will buy the book Human Rights and Peace, A Personal Odyssey, supports Malta because a certain percentage goes to the Malta conference, to me, but to the Malta conference. So anything okay. I can, I try to do. Many of us, the organizers, donate too. So this is how we raise the money. I thought that we will find during the years a sugar daddy that will believe in peace in the Middle East and will take it over, because for a rich person, $350,000 every 2 years is peanuts. They spend it on one trip on a yacht. But apparently we did not find this sugar daddy till now.
Right.
Maybe he's listening to you and he will contact me. So I'll have to give my contact information. But yes, the fundraising and the visa is a big, big problem. Yes, yes.
Okay, so let me ask you just sort of I'm trying to get lessons from your experience that will be helpful to others. Did you put I'm going to say a board of directors. I don't know if that's the right even terminology.
Yeah, have a board.
The board of advisors, or who's helping you? Do you have an executive director?
Oh, there is a very big difference between the board of directors and who is helping you. The board of directors is on the stationery. They get a lot of prestige, but helping is a completely different story. Few of them help, few of them donate, few of them raise money, and few of them enjoy seeing their names on the stationery. It's a tough thing. People are very enthusiastic till they get on the board, but a lot falls on my shoulder, and this is a big problem. And now we are trying, but it's a vicious circle. No, we don't have a paid employee. Everybody is volunteers, because every penny we raise goes towards the Middle East. 100% of the money we raise goes to the Middle East.
So, and do you have at this point an executive director, or I'm just trying to differentiate at this point, what is your role versus somebody who runs the
my
operations?
Role is a president, but I'm the executive director too.
Okay, so you got all of this hat.
I have all of that, yes.
Okay. Well, we need to wrap this up in a minute, but I just want to ask you, take advantage. I'm taking advantage of the fact that you have so much insight and expertise, if you would give a little bit of a comment on this. So as you and I are speaking, we're in the middle of Iran war, if I call it that, here in the middle of March. Do you have any insights, or what do you think is going to happen here? Well, how is all this going to play out in a few words?
My biggest fear personally that it will torpedo my next conference that is in the beginning of May, because most of the countries that are involved in the conference are under attack, all of them. The Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain, even Turkey got some missile, Israel for sure, the Palestinian, Lebanon is a different war with Hezbollah that is part of the Iranian regime. So there are no really regular flights even going. Now the conference is scheduled for Baku, Azerbaijan, that promised to give visa for everybody, and it was supposed to be a very easy place. But Baku was attacked with few missiles from Iran, and their airport was attacked. So the first thing, personally, I'm afraid that in May, we will not be able to hold the conference, although everything is ready. Hotels, everything, all the lectures, the program, we are all set to go. But I don't see how it will be possible. So this is the first thing.
No.
The second thing, not personally for the Malta conference, that it's terrible because everybody is waiting for that and wanting to get together and work together. I have even the Nobel laureates that are supposed to go. Who knows what will happen? It just gets more and more complicated, and with the price of oil and with closing the Straits of Hormuz, the price of oil can go much higher. Iran is attacking the oil refineries in the Gulf, the Emirates, the Saudis, the U.S. and Israel are attacking their oil. It doesn't look like it's going to end well. The idea was to bring freedom to the people of Iran that came out and demonstrated, and 35,000 of them were killed. And,
right.
But now, who knows what can happen? It's
well. I will just say, as somebody who knows a number of obviously people from Israel, Palestinians, and also from Iran, I was host for families from Iran who were coming to the U.S. some years ago. It's just painful to hear and read about and see all of this that they're going through. I mean, for just very complicated, difficult historical reasons, and they're all also wonderful people, wonderful culture, and yet, you know, this is the experience they're having today.
Big number from Iran of people. That's why I have a lot of friends in Iran.
Yes.
But everybody is suffering. All the countries that get ballistic missiles are suffering because there are a lot of people hurt in all these countries. So it's here I have a model for peace, but the politicians don't want to hear about models like that.
Right.
Somebody asked me in an interview, so how do you think we can have peace? I said, if we will ever succeed in removing the politicians. The people don't want to fight. I have a lot of Iranian friends. I have a lot of Palestinian friends. I'm in touch with everybody. So now with Iran, it's very hard because they don't have internet. But I'm in touch with all my participants that are praying all the time so they can get together, all of them. But it's... And then the poor people of Iran that are suffering from this regime, especially the women. You don't know how many great Iranian women scientists they have. Women are head of a lot of institutes there. They are in very high position, women scientists. And it's... it's very sad how they are treated, how they have to be dressed. And 35,000 people were killed in January. It's terrible.
Well, I certainly pray for peace and somehow hope we can find a way through all this for peace for everybody in the region. They're all wonderful, wonderful people and human beings and cultures. And anyway, as an American, I'm just speaking for myself, but I know, I'm sure you share the same sentiments.
Well, so, spend my life for peace.
So, Zephra, you are fantastic. I am a great admirer of you. Thank you for coming on to the Create the Future podcast and sharing your experience as a leader, as somebody who's doing something really authentically important, and sharing what you've, you know, what worked, didn't work, what you had to do to make all this happen. So if someone wants to learn more about you, how to get in touch with you and your book, of course, how can they do that?
Okay, I have a website by myself that is Zephra Lerman, my name, Zephra Lerman, Zephra Lerman, oneword.com. This website will direct you to the website of the Malta conferences. That we have a website that is more complicated. It's all one word, Malta Conferences Foundation.org. But my own website directs it to there. And the book is Human Rights of Peace and Peace, A Personal Odyssey. Amazon now sells it, thank God, in paperback because they charge a fortune for the hardcover. And everybody that buys a book donates something to the conference because the proceeds go to the conference. And if anybody is interested in knowing more, my email is, again, Zephra, Zephra, at zephralerman.com.
Okay, that's great. And I think people should reach out to you and make contact with you. I think you're super. So I also want to thank our audience. Thank you. I also want to thank our audience for tuning in and listening to the podcast. I hope you found this as valuable as I have. I know there's a lot of important lessons that come out from hearing someone like our guest who has actually succeeded in bringing together really important initiatives. I hope you found our discussion compelling, valuable, and also engaging. I have two requests. The first request is that you follow this podcast on your favorite podcast channel. By following the podcast, you'll hear when the next podcast episode is out. Second, if you have a compelling story to tell about tough decisions you had to make, come on the podcast as a guest. Go to rickwilliamsleadership.com and then go to the podcast page on the website. Again, that's rickwilliamsleadership.com. Be well.